Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 141, with guests, Real World Theology contributor Laura Fissel, and also joining us from the Strangers and Aliens podcast, author Ben Avery. So listen up, because we've got a show where the motion capture is so good, you'll swear that we're real. On this episode, we talk War for the Planet of the Apes and modern biblical narratives.
Maybe it's because Laura is one of the people that I've seen get most excited about the Planet of the Apes movies. Maybe that's why I assumed you were on the last one, which makes me feel bad. You know, Wade, I'm sorry that I forgot you were on the last episode for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes with Ben. I guess I've had more conversations with Laura about the Planet of the Apes movies. And we did have our Planet of the Apes marathon before...
Rise.
Was it before Rise? Mm-hmm. I couldn't remember if it was before we saw Rise or if we liked Rise enough that like you wanted to go back and watch the originals.
No, so the originals were movies I was very interested in, but my parents didn't want us to watch for some reason. And I honestly can't remember why they didn't like them. But so I had seen snippets of them like on TV and I'd never watched all of them back to back. So we, well, except for the Tim Burton one. We watched them before Rise came out.
This is why I feel like I should listen to my my own podcast more. Because I thought I remember having a specific conversation with you and Ben. Where Ben went through and talked about how much he liked or didn't like all of the original Planet of the Apes movies.
I think Ben did do that. Yeah. But I didn't. Yeah.
And then Ben talked about how he was really into the animated Planet of the Apes series and then went on like a super nerdy tangent about it. And I was like, I picked the right person for this episode.
I made a good choice.
All I know is that at one point you sent an email out about, I think it was Terminator, and you said something like, And we'll just let you start talking and then we'll get out of your way because last time you were on. And it's like, oh, shoot, did I do that? I can't get excited about things like this. So.
Well, no, it's good. Like I said, I'm just trying to figure out how I pieced Laura into that puzzle. Maybe it's just because I want you around for all things because you make everything better.
Oh, so sweet.
Look at that, right?
I got to figure out why I like the originals so much because I can freely admit to anyone that most of them are extremely boring. Well, at least the first two I feel like are extremely boring, but I still love them. I mean, I would watch them again and again.
But you came into it as an adult?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Well, I mean, yeah, I watched them fully as an adult for the first time, but
you probably saw snippets of them.
I saw snippets of the... especially the first one when I was a kid on TV, like all the time, just little different parts of it. And it just really intrigued me. I really, really wanted to watch the whole thing.
I wonder if it was the first one that you saw over and over. Because I remember it was, oh man. I feel like it was the one where it was Cornelius, I think, that I saw on TV all the time. Whichever one that was. If only I knew.
Not the one where they get in the pod and they come to the future or the past.
I think it's the one after that. The third one, maybe?
That is the third one.
Yeah, the second one's just.
Or the present day 70s.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, that one's good. I really like that
one.
That might be my favorite one of the originals.
If only I could remember which one Ben's favorite was, but I bet he hadn't even seen these in so long. He probably doesn't even remember.
It actually has been a while since I've seen them. I haven't watched them it's been at least since Rise. I watched the first one with my kids. Actually, my son really wanted to see the new ones and I made him watch the first one just so he could know what they were referencing.
How old was he? And how did he feel about it?
He's 15. Okay. He liked it. He liked it well enough. I mean, he He doesn't ever want to watch that one again, but yeah. I bet that he'd be willing to watch the other ones in the series.
Mm-hmm.
But then he loved the first two in this trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he really, really liked them. And we actually, it was fun because I was talking about how we're in the camp season. In between 2 weeks of camp, it was just Tim and I alone for the weekend. And we watched a ton of movies, just a ton. And those were two of them.
Cool.
We watched like Jason, the first Bourne movie. And
were they rewatches for him?
No. They were the first time he'd ever seen them. Okay. He just really wanted to see them. And we just hadn't gotten around to it because it's hard. We have five kids and one of them's six. And so it's difficult for us to find time to watch things that not everyone can or wants to watch.
Yeah.
And so that was just our opportunity to just watch some guy movies that the girls might have liked it, but it wasn't something they were clamoring for.
Yeah.
And he loved them. And so then the other thing was I wanted to make sure we got a chance to watch them before this third one came out, because if he liked them, then I wanted to be able to take him to see this third one. So
did you get to take him?
I did not get to take him to see the third one yet.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So we're still working on that one.
I know this is going to be fairly unrelated, but it's something I'm curious about. One, as a parent now, and two, because you know we're talking about movies in the context of to a great degree discernment.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you tend to go see all movies by yourself first, and then you choose like movies for kids, or are there movies that you're pretty confident that you can take children to?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm confident, I'll go ahead and do it, and I haven't been burned yet.
Can you give an example of something you're pretty confident in?
I was pretty confident in Star Wars.
Okay.
So I took all but my youngest. No, I didn't take my youngest daughter to the last one, but she will be going to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
And it'll be I took them all to the midnight show. Mm-hmm. Or not the 7 o'clock midnight show.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's actually why I didn't take Tim to see this one. I was just planning on just letting him go. It was PG-13. I checked the little box next to the PG-13 to see what it said.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if I'm not sure, but I don't want to actually watch a movie twice. Like I can't think of when I've done this, but I'll read like the reviews.
Yeah.
You know, like the Plugged In review, because it leans super conservative.
Yeah.
And it also gets very detailed. And the one, especially one of the writers on there, I can't remember his name, but I really trust him. I think it's John. Oh, I know it's John.
Well, that's a pretty safe bet in general.
Yeah, he wrote a book about Batman. and he writes for Focus on the Family. But and they'll give you a really detailed account of what's in there. And I know what my kids can handle and what I want my kids to handle too. Because that's the other thing, is there's certain things where I'm like, I know my kids.
Yeah.
It wouldn't totally disrupt their development at all. But I don't necessarily want to be the one who's going to take them to that movie to see that thing for the first time, you know, and we can wait on this. And that's the other thing, is there's things that I'm seeing now where I'm like, you know, it wouldn't be super harmful if they saw it right now, but there's no reason for them to see it right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll watch it with them when, you know, later. They're not totally missing out on something by waiting until I deem it proper or appropriate for them. And when they hit, you know, 18, 19, 20, whatever, when they're off in college, then they'll be like me and have to make the same choices that they have to make. But
yeah, I kind of try to think back, and I realize that it won't be a one for one, because we live, you know, in a get it now kind of social media, everything's at your fingertips kind of craze, culture. But I remember I never went to movies when I was a kid. I think like I went like once with like a youth group, and we went to see like the Little Mermaid, you know, and like I just don't ever remember going to the theater.
Well, that's the other thing, is I don't take my kids to the theater very often anyway. Yeah. It's expensive.
It is.
And, I mean, even though we've got a theater near us that first run weekend of release movies will sometimes be, if you catch it at the right time, I'm looking for what's available for when I can go, but it'll be $6.95 for a ticket. And like, that's, I can live with that, you know, and if it's me and two of my kids, I can live with that.
Mm-hmm.
But once you're talking about like going to see a Disney movie or something with all five of my kids and my wife,
yeah,
then it's, I can't live with that. I just can't.
Yeah, that's tough. Let me posit this. In another tangential thing, I want to basically cover all the big things before we actually talk about the movie. There's been talk recently, and I'm wondering if you're almost like a prime candidate for this, but of the idea of being able to rent new releases for, like, you know, a much higher price, like, say, like $50. Like, you, you can rent a movie the weekend it comes out and watch it in your home for, like, $50. Would you be more apt to do that, to see the film with your family for, or maybe, you know, invite a couple other people over and to kind of disperse the cost? Or is the movie theater experience important in that taking the family to the movies process?
The movie theater experience is not the end all and be all necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
If I was, let's go up even higher. If it was like $75,
mm-hmm,
and it was my family and like my nieces and nephews and brother-in-law, sister-in-law, if it was like a couple families getting together, I could see that being actually a really fun time.
Mm-hmm.
I would be open. I'd be open to that. The movie experience is good. It's a fun experience. It's mm-hmm. not, and there's some movies that you almost want to experience that big.
Yeah.
And like Gravity, I'll never watch again, but
it's true.
I, on the big screen in 3D, it mm-hmm. was an experience that I really, really enjoyed. Trying to think of some other things that, Batman, the second, The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that in IMAX, and then I saw it again in IMAX, and I vowed I would never watch it again because it was so amazing on that big screen. But then when the third one came out, I went ahead and watched it again.
But
on my TV, it was just, man.
Dumb old TV.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. There's some that you want the experience, and that would be the one thing where it's like, okay, is this a big, giant movie? Godzilla, King Kong, Skull Island, that was big.
Yeah.
We
still may talk about that. We'll see.
Okay. Well, I want to. I've got stuff to say. I said stuff about it.
I can say it again.
But yeah. I would not mind saying it again. You know me.
Yeah. So. Well, that's the thing. We we're gonna see what September and probably early October shape up to be like. I feel like they're putting out so many movies every year that the what I would consider the dead zones are becoming less and less dead.
Yeah.
It used to, you know, it usually was that you could basically get nothing from like February to March, most of April. And now they release great movies in February now. And March is still kind of slow, but the end of March is basically when like the pre-summer blockbusters come out.
Because there's no place else for it to go.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got three Marvel movies and a Star Wars movie every year now.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Disney's eating its own tail here
yeah.
with all the movies they're putting out with a live action fairy tale and then mm-hmm. an animated movie. I mean, they're eating up all the prime real estate already,
mm-hmm.
let alone any of these other franchises.
Well, I was saying, I think DC's at least on like the 2-year train now. And,
yeah.
So like, you know, you know what your film year is going to look like 4 years out now. So
yeah.
I literally did that mid last year. I did, like, because the Marvel schedule was, you know, Disney put its schedule out, and then, you know, DC had its stuff out, and then enough, you know, I knew War for the Planet of the Apes was coming out. I was like, I can't wait for a year from now.
I know, it's crazy. Yeah.
But
they're sinking so much money into it. They have to know that they're going to get their money back, and so that's where you they have to start the word of mouth.
Yeah.
Sooner is better than later on a lot of these bigger things.
Yeah. So here's my transition. Like, you're talking about things worth seeing in the theater because they're big spectacles. And mm-hmm. I would argue that War for the Planet of the Apes is one of those spectacles. It's being referred to as a blockbuster. And there are lots of people who are now, after seeing War for the Planet of the Apes, are referring to it as essential and significant. Like, there's some big talk about how, like, either good or important this movie is. And, like I said, it's still coming with the little moniker, the little stamp that says, blockbuster. And, or, you know, summer blockbuster. Which is, again, weird for me to think about the Planet of the Apes movies being blockbusters. But Dawn of the Planet of the Apes came out basically the exact same weekend, however many years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. 3 years ago, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
So it's not like they're trying to hide the fact that these are summer-type movies, but I'm curious. I know we all like the movie, but Laura, I want you to jump in here. Because I'm basically going to ask Ben random family questions.
You're like, I'm not going to ask Laura. She doesn't know.
She doesn't know.
She's in the same place I'm in.
Yeah, she's in literally the exact same place I am with having children. Oddly enough. So I'm curious if you would consider, like, words essential or significant when you think about War for the Planet of the Apes.
I'm still kind of pondering that. I think it's definitely not that I didn't like War for the Planet of the Apes, but I remember leaving Dawn and being like, oh man, I really love that. And being able to articulate why and the parts that I loved.
Mm-hmm.
This one was just, it was just different for me. And I think maybe because it was really heavy pretty much the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I kind of think of a little bit that, that Bad Ape was kind of, he was supposed to be silly, but I think that if I hadn't needed the comic relief so much, then I maybe wouldn't even have really liked his character that much,
mm-hmm.
but I was just so grateful, I think, to be able to laugh that I was just like, it really had the effect that it was supposed to have, I think, on me, his scenes, but so it's just been more difficult for me to kind of sort through how I feel about it and why I feel that way. And, I don't know, maybe just the things that I have come away with are so heavy and so loaded that it's more difficult for me to sort through them. But, I mean, I definitely liked it. I think it was an appropriate, wonderful end to the trilogy, and I'm so glad that it is doing well. But I'm just eager to talk about it and kind of sort through some stuff. I'm a verbal processor, so it really helps me to talk about it with people.
Well, that works. So,
did you say you're a verbal processor?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I'm more internal. But...
Yeah. Same.
So you already know how you feel. You're just going to tell us.
Yeah.
No, I've been mulling it over a lot. Because what we do on Strangers and Aliens with the summer movies is we record ourselves driving to the movie, and then record ourselves right afterward driving home from the movie, and so it's our initial reaction. And there's been a couple movies where I've just been like so pumped that, oh yeah, this was so awesome. And then later on, I'm thinking maybe I should have pulled back a little on my rhetoric. But, and this is one, I really love this coming out of the theater. One of my hosts, the co-hosts, hated it. It was amazing. We saw two different movies, but then I've also listened to another podcast recently where all three of them gave it basically not recommend a thumbs down.
I can't imagine. Yeah. I really can't imagine why.
Well, it was a lot of the same problems that Evan had with it, but
just too good, too enjoyable. Yeah, yeah. Had too much thematic weight.
Just too well thought out.
Yeah. Looked too good. Well acted. Script was just amazing.
Here's where I start worrying, though, and this I'm going to throw this back at you two to see if you're thinking about this too. But once you start throwing like capital I important,
mm-hmm.
and labeling it, you know, as essential, I could live with as I think it is essential viewing, especially this summer. Mm-hmm. But just to say it's significant and it's important, and I wonder if those are too strong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
I was gonna say, so I'm thinking about that, and I think the one of the biggest problems is I really liked but didn't like absolutely love this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, much like the previous movies, it was really good. Like Dawn, it was really good. But it wasn't like the best movie I'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to think of even the word essential, I did have people saying, man, now that I've seen War for the Planet of the Apes, I might consider this trilogy one of the best trilogies of all time. And like, when someone says that right after I get out of the movie, I'm like, yeah, I kind of get that. Like, this really is a good trilogy. Like, it, you know, you're kind of intrigued with Rise. You know, there's plenty of flaws. It's not really a complete thought, but there's a lot of good pieces there. And when it's followed up with Dawn, you're like, oh, they are going somewhere very specific with this, and this could be great. Mm-hmm. And then War, I think, does not disappoint with that trajectory. I don't think it quite hits maybe like the highest of highs, but it, like I said, again, in a summer filled with, you know, Transformers, or Pirates of the Caribbean, movies
it's
that
gonna
I'm
going to shine out.
Yeah. Movies that I'm perfectly willing to see anyway. Like this movie is significantly better. And I would say, I think just like you said, Ben, is it essential this summer? Sure. You know, but I think someone had a poll. It might've been on Phil and Film or something like that. They're fond of polls. I think they put like, what is your favorite trilogy? And I was expecting this to get a lot of votes until and seeing all like the famous trilogies of history in one place, mm-hmm. I go, oh, well, yeah, it's still, even though I really like this is still like 6, 7, 8 mm-hmm. for me. You know, so
I'd like to see that poll because I was thinking through this whole trilogy thing and I realized I can't think of any trilogies right now. I can think of Lord of the Rings and Hobbit. But then when I started thinking of other trilogies, I realized they're not trilogies anymore. You know, like they've added the fourth movie.
Well, but you could still, I think you can still,
could you say like the original Star Wars is a trilogy?
Yeah. Like you could say the original Star Wars. I think
that's easy for me to parse.
Yeah. But. I think you could, you know, like there's still only been 3 Indiana Jones movies, just in case anyone wants to pick up the conversation we had from the last episode. I would still choose the Indiana Jones movies over this trilogy. I would choose Star Wars over this trilogy. I would choose Lord of the Rings over this trilogy.
Now, I wonder if... So you have to admit that the motion capture stuff is really remarkable. I feel like maybe some of that is getting caught up in that assessment of this film.
Mm-hmm.
And
in what assessment?
The positive, like thinking that it is so essential and it's so remarkable. I think it's a really good movie and I love the series. But it's not, I wouldn't consider it like the top trilogy of all time or anything like that. And I just kind of wonder if people are so amazed by what they were able to do and the emotion they were able to get the apes and that kind of starstruck, you know what I'm saying? Like that might be kind of part of the wonder of this film. And it's not solely being judged on story or craft or, you know?
Well, I think you're right. I do think you're right. I mean, you brought up story. That's the main thing I'm seeing thrown against this is that the story beats don't make sense sometimes. And the character decisions sometimes feel like, this is not me, but other people saying that the character decisions seem to be like, just, we got to move the movie this way. And so that's why Caesar's going to do this is because that's where the movie has to go, because that's the movie we want to make it. And so he's going to do that. And even though he wouldn't have made this choice if you were really following his character arc or something like that. And so I think that the emotion though, of the motion capture, it's all there. Like you can see Andy Serkis in the face, and he gives a very emotional performance. And I agree about the story itself is thin. It's a thin plot, and it's a plot we've seen many, many times before. Mm-hmm. But there's emotion behind it, and there's characters that we like. And if you don't like the characters, you're not going to like this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you're going to like it if you don't have an attachment already to the characters that in the first two movies, you won't like it as much anyway. But and then some of the themes that they're trying to say, I really appreciate that they're trying to say something with this big blockbuster movie. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's a lot about this movie. I'm going to throw my cards on the table here. When I got out of the movie, I was so glad that my son couldn't see it because I got to go see it again. You know, I haven't yet, but I get to.
Yeah.
Because he's – I don't know if he'll like it or not. But the other thing is I as much as I liked it, I was very surprised then to see how many like reviews were thinking a lot of the same things that I was, because I was thinking, am I just giving it to this movie? Am I just you know, seeing things in this movie because I want to see these things? Which I sometimes do, you know, and that goes into my appreciation of the movie less than, you know, I'm not trying to convince other people that you should love this movie. I was really surprised how much my co-host hated it. Mm-hmm. He really hated it. It was really funny. Mm-hmm.
Sounds like it's time for a new co-host.
Well, the other thing about this movie, I feel like, Mikey, you've said to me, and I agree with, is that, I don't think it would necessarily fall completely apart if you had only watched this one and not watched the other ones, but you're invested in Caesar because you've seen his development. I mean, you've seen his character arc over two other films.
Yeah.
So I don't know what it would feel like to come upon that character as a completely new character to me, but I do feel like it would lose some of that emotional weight if you weren't familiar with him already and hadn't watched, you know, basically his entire life, his entire development as an ape, as a leader, you know.
Well, I think I tried to raise that point to someone recently and they shot me down hard. They said, oh, you know, I took someone who hadn't seen Dawn and there was enough context there that they understood the whole Koba stuff. And I was like, I just don't feel like you could. Like, you could understand, again, contextually, like the idea of the Koba stuff, but not the depth of the Koba stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the emotion's lost on you.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's like reading a list versus experiencing the actual events, and you know, being like, oh, okay, well, there's some dark part of him that's, you know, haunting him. Mm-hmm. Okay, I get that. But like to have watched Dawn and see how many times he forgave Koba.
Mm-hmm. And that they actually had a deep friendship and love for each other.
So like, I just, you know, like, I'm not saying that you'd be lost with war, but I feel like there is some resonance. Well, I mean, the thing was that he said, you know, both him and his friend really love the movie. So I was like, well, I feel like he would have really loved the movie. Like, sure, he really loved it, but he would have really loved it. Yeah. I did just for you, Ben, find that poll.
Okay.
And it is at Fill and Film. And I'll throw out a couple of these just for an idea before we shift back into it. But, you know, we've already mentioned Lord of the Rings. We mentioned Star Wars. So technically the Dark Knight trilogy, which we Back to the Future.
That one I did remember. And I would put this above Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Even with my emotional I love those movies. But
yeah, I think I would too, probably. Yeah. Toy Story. At least for now.
For now.
For another year, I think. Then Indiana Jones, Captain America gets a nod as being a trilogy at this point.
Yeah.
Which I think is a little bit of a cheat, but still on there. The Godfather, the Cornetto trilogy, which I would probably put maybe above this.
Is that really a trilogy, though?
Well, I mean,
It's three movies thematically linked. I haven't seen.
What do you want from a trilogy, Ben?
Well, I mean, to me, a trilogy is not thematically linked. Like, if we're going theme linking,
it's like direct correlation.
Yeah, it's story, it's characters, it's
yeah.
I agree with that.
So I mean, because there's plenty of trilogies that, like, there's Terry Gilliam's movies. You know, there's the dystopic trilogy. There's the Americana trilogy. I mean, you could go. I mean, there's
so they have some of them too. They have like the Three Colors trilogy. They have one that's actually that adheres more with the Before trilogy. The Before Midnight,
Before Sunrise.
Yes, Let's see, The Hobbit technically is its own trilogy. You know, that people never finished. Or people were still trying to finish watching because it's so long. Let's see. The Karate Kid.
I feel like you're reading the whole list now.
I'm trying to hit the good ones. I mean, it's a very long list. People, you know, because it was one of those lists anyone could add anything to. So, you know, I think in consideration, I think it is a top-tier, notable trilogy, but it's, you know, it's not the top of my list.
I think it's best appreciated as a trilogy, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because of what Laura was saying. I mean, you watch him get born. I mean, you start with his mother.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you end with him, you know, dying and seeing, you know, his son getting ready to move on with life. But
spoilers, just in case you've never listened to this podcast before.
Well, I thought we were already spoiled things, but
yeah. Well, I mean, like, yeah, like just okay. A reminder that we're going to spoil an episode. If you were listening to a thematic review of a movie, we're going to talk about the whole thing. So, okay. So something that you said earlier, Ben, and that I think we've already hinted at a little bit is you said, you know, this is a plot that we've seen many times before. So it wasn't really necessarily surprising to you, but at the same time, that's part of what makes it so good, because something that a plot that you've seen before that is still interesting, is still great, that makes you want to go to the theater and pay the $6.25 or whatever to see it again, I think that accounts for something. But in this
Except okay. When I paid my money in the theater, I wasn't expecting to see this movie. And that's another thing that I see people throw at it. And that's probably Evan's biggest beef with it. It's called War for the Planet of the Apes. But a lot of the complaints I've seen about it is, well, where's the war? We see one battle at the beginning of the movie. And then the battle at the end is not between the apes and the humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so who's warring for the Planet of the Apes?
But it's still a war for the Planet of the Apes.
Well, I mean, we can parse out all those, you know, things, but that is one of the complaints I see lodged against it, is that the title is misleading and that the advertising and the trailers and things were misleading.
Mm.
And even further than that, I guess there was a special, a making of special on like HBO or something. And I haven't seen this, but apparently it makes it look like it's a war epic, you know, and that's what I was expecting. I was expecting to go in and see a war epic. I was still expecting it to be personal, but what I appreciated about it when I realized I wasn't going to get that was it was personal. This was about, I mean, for me, the war for the Planet of the Apes was not fought between the two human armies or the apes and the humans. It was Caesar's war. I mean, it was within. So that's where I'm okay with the title. I'm fine with it. You know,
yeah, I do feel like it's nitpicking a little bit because, you know, so if you even go look at some of the movies that the writer and director, Matt Reeves, kind of said was inspirational for the film, like you're talking about like Bridge Over the River Kwai, you know, like.
Yeah.
Is that not a war movie? Like, there's very few, you know, huge battle scenes in that. What are you defining as a war movie? I guess if you're expecting a war epic, even then I would say that movie is still an epic war movie. It's one of the most epic war movies ever, but it doesn't have a lot of, you know, battles.
But it's expectation going in.
Yeah.
So. That.
Well, and also I can never remember the titles of all the original Planet of the Apes movies, but isn't there one that is, I guess
it's battle.
Okay. Yeah. And that is
battle.
Yeah. That is like the act of war. You see that playing out in the streets.
Yeah.
And there is a battle in that movie between some school buses.
Yeah.
And some,
it's very Mad Max-y.
It is. It's surprisingly Mad Max-y.
Do you know, I actually don't know off the top of your head if it came out after the Road Warrior, do you?
Thinking
it's like the last one, isn't it?
It is the last one, and I don't know the year off the top of my head, but I'm still thinking it's pre-Star Wars, and I'm not sure, is Mad Max 79?
Well, except which one?
We're gonna look up. The first one is what I'm thinking, not Mad Max, but Road Warrior.
Road Warrior, have to look that up. So
this movie seemed more like about the consequences of war, like the effects of war, than it was about the act of war.
The war basically is over at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see the last battle of the war between humans and apes. At least Caesar and his tribe's last battle.
Yeah.
That's at the very beginning of the movie. I mean, after that, Caesar's on his quest for revenge, and then they all get captured, and then they escape. You know, that's you're going through like all the different ape movie titles. You know, they battle, they escape. But yeah, I mean, it's so to call it a war movie. I mean, Apocalypse Now, that's a war movie, definitely, but it's not with big, huge battles or anything like that. And yeah. That's another one that they definitely are referencing here. And The Great Escape is another one that they mention.
Yeah.
But then they also talk about Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments. And uh-huh. You want to talk about – I think this is a better Moses movie than Exodus was, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so that's what I was kind of winding down to anyway. So – like you said this is a plot we've seen many times before, and they freely admit that, you know, the filmmakers freely admit that they specifically went and looked at all these sources, and some of those being like biblical stories, you know, it's hard to throw a stone on the internet without hitting a review that talks about like the biblical parallels. So you know, you have Caesar in this one as a Moses figure, not just like occasionally, but often, you know, you have an entire race of people, or race of apes, you know, being slave labor, not building pyramids, but, you know, all moving stones to build a wall, you know, like various, you know, this is all, you know, Israel in captivity. You know, even from the very beginning of the film, you have Caesar's son, Blue Eyes, and Rocket coming back from scouting a land filled with milk and honey, the future home, you know.
But you can go even further back than that. I mean, if you want to go all the way back, he's, as a child, raised, you know, not by his family, but by the opposition that ends up being, I mean, he's raised by humans, just as, you know, Moses was raised in Pharaoh's court. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you can take it all the way back there. That's what I love about this trilogy, is that this one, I don't necessarily think that they were thinking that this is going to be the end the whole way, but this movie definitely draws on all of those strings and themes that they planted early on. Mm-hmm. And it may not do so in a way that's satisfactory for everyone, but it was certainly satisfactory for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually thinking about how, like, the biblical parallels have been, like I said, again, repeatedly pointed out. In review after review for war. But just like you're saying, for like Rise, like now going back, the pieces are there throughout everything. I even thought about how in Dawn, when we first come upon the apes in Dawn, it almost seems like they're living in like a type of Eden. Like everyone's harmony. They have like the law that's almost been given to them. Mm-hmm. Like it's very simple. You know, it's not even 10 commandments. It's just like, you know,
there's two.
Yeah. There's two. There's two commandments.
You know, apes together strong and ape not kill ape. There are two commandments.
Yeah. And they have their kids, they're learning, they're, you know, they're teaching each other to hunt, they're being familial. And it's not until, you know, like kind of sin creeps in and those two rules are broken, that they're now basically in exile. Like they're banished from this perfect thing. And now, you know, the metaphor obviously breaks down on a lot of levels, but it's just kind of, it's kind of interesting to see, like this progression and how we continue over and over to see, biblical parallels. And I think it says a lot, because again, a plot we've seen many times before. And they, you know, people are like, hey, if I want to make something feel epic, I'm going to a story that felt epic. Now it's updated and it's not one for one, but it's enough, especially in war, where you can say it's, you know, it's the best biblical story I've seen in a while, or it's the best Moses story I've ever seen, you know, kind of things like that, without really skipping too many beats.
That reference to Adam and Eve really resonates with me for what I was seeing in war. I actually, I kind of felt Well, I did feel stupid when I was reading people's reviews because I did not see any of the biblical imagery, like, when I was watching the film. It just wasn't, it wasn't the thing that jumped out at me. I saw the reference to historical wars. I saw a reference to the Holocaust, you know, but I didn't see any of that biblical stuff. But the thing that really thematically jumped out to me was kind of this idea that we, and I feel like I see it in the apes mostly because they're kind, they've been kind of gradually gaining this kind of awareness that we would maybe associate with humanity, you know, language and morality. And, I think that we want to believe that we can have those gifts that come with being human, that come with being, having a soul. Mm-hmm. But we think that, I just think we start to take too much ownership of that and believe that we can have that without having the other part of that, which is that when God gave us life, that when we were put in the garden, he allowed us to have choice. And as long as we have that, you know, our nature is going to be corrupted. We're always going to be, our souls are always going to be at war, flesh and spirit. So I just really, I loved how that played out in this film because you have someone who is very obviously like an evil example that we would objectively call an evil example of the soul or of the human, which would be the kernel. And then you have someone who is obviously the good, noble, you know, version of the human, which is Caesar, but both of them become corrupted by, just their own need to follow. I don't, you know, really just for, they're corrupted by claiming for themselves, like, this is my purpose, or this is how I'm going to take control of my life, or I don't know. I just feel like it was a really good example of how humanity, whether we call that like a good person or a bad person, or we're all susceptible to sin nature. I don't know. I really loved, I just kept thinking of this phrase that we, let's see, how did I phrase it in my notes? Well, just that both of them became the thing that they hated. Like, Caesar was starting to become Koba, and the colonel at the end becomes, you know, a mute human. Yeah.
Like he had one goal. Like, he had one job, colonel.
Don't become this thing. So I don't know. And just in the colonel's speech about, you know, holy purpose or whatever, it just made me think about how when we start to take control of, really just control of our lives and eliminate that there's any kind of outside force that has any bearing on our lives or any say in our lives, I think we start to go in a direction that is going to be destructive. So I don't know if any of that made sense, but that was the main thing that I came away with.
None of it.
Good. I'll start over again.
Okay. So one thing I was really chewing on were those journeys, like the journey of both Caesar and the colonel, and how they were faced with something terrible, and they allowed fear and or revenge or some, you know, kind of anger basically to dictate how they were going to resolve the issue instead of letting something else dictate that, like concern for others. I mean, the colonel, like, the reason that he's a pretty decent bad guy is because you can kind of say, all right, it's probably not the way I would do it, but you are trying to preserve something. So you have a very warped perspective on how to get it. Like, the sacrifice might not be worth the end goal.
And he really believes it. So it's not like he's trying to manipulate people necessarily. Like
he is not, he's practicing what he preaches by even, you know, killing his own son. But at the same time, everything he's doing is out of fear. It's not like out of obedience or anything like that. It's all out of fear. Like, we want to survive. I mean, it's honestly, I feel like I've done this on previous podcasts. It's when you talk about, Bible stories, I think one of the coolest things about stories in the Bible are that basically every time we read them, we almost always associate ourselves with the hero. or the person who overcomes. And in almost every case, if an objective observer were to place us in that story, we would probably always be the worst person in the story.
Hmm.
And even in some cases, the person who doesn't get redeemed, because we would not make the right choice. Like I was almost overcome by the fact that, like, I realized that, like, I am Israel in almost the entire Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Like I keep doing things that I shouldn't do. You know, I'm not like, oh, I'm really David. I made a mistake, but ultimately I'm after God's own heart. You know, like, that's not really me. I am terrible. You know, and I don't want to, like, hark on that, but that's basically what fear leads to. Like, you're the worst. So I think when people watch this movie, they're like, yeah, we're all Caesar. You know, we all have a little Coba in us, but we just need to be less Coba and more Caesar. Like, I
that's what I'm talking about, though. I think when we think we can control that,
yeah,
that's when we go in that direction.
Yeah. I think if we're anything, what I see when I have conversations on social media, or I see people sharing enlightening things on social media, or having conversations that they're just...
Were those air quotes, by the way?
Yeah, yeah.
Enlightening? Okay.
Yeah.
I couldn't see them.
But you,
but you can hear
you
them.
You can feel them.
But I heard them.
Yeah. Or, you know, when someone is, I'm just telling you how it is, or just watch out, because, like, all I hear are a bunch of kernels, people who are living in fear of whatever it is. You know, I'm feared the immigrants are going to take over. I'm afeared of the Muslims, or I'm afeared that they're going to oppress the Christians, or I'm afeared that they're going to do this to healthcare, or I'm afeared that they're not going to do this to healthcare. And, 'cause everyone's from, like, the 1860s, so everyone's afeared of things.
Yeah, I was wondering what that accent was.
Yeah. From the South. So, like I said, it's just like good biblical stories. I feel like it gives us, we can read it and identify with the person who overcomes, but honestly, if you think about it, we're probably the person who is the worst in the movie. And I think most people I see, including myself, if I really think about it, is the kernel, even though I try not to be.
Mm-hmm.
I try not to let the decisions I make be ruled by fear. I hope they're ruled by hope and faith and something bigger than my circumstances. But honestly, I mean, there are lots of decisions that I make based on fear of not having any money, like fear of losing my family, fear of losing the respect of people, fear of becoming mute because of some kind of weird ape disease, you know, normal things. So, that really jumped out at me. And like I said, I don't want to go too far without actually, again, pointing out the fact that one of the things I really loved and that was, emotionally weighty was the idea of the visual that we got over and over of seeing Caesar wrestle with his inner Coba, kind of proving that, like, there is something else there.
Man, that's why Moses is such a great parallel for this, because, you know, even you can see in the Bible that all of the heroes, let's just say, of Scripture were flawed. And that's a comfort. That should be a comfort, I think, to us to know that grace abounds. But I just feel like Moses is, he's so identifiable because he just messes up so much. I mean, just more than the average person. I mean, when I think of, like, Abraham, you know, he messed up too, but I just think of, like, these really noble things that he did, you know, that seem to kind of outweigh the bad things he did. But with Moses, it just seems undeniable that he just kept falling down and falling down and falling down. And yet, you know, he was loved by God, and he did God's work, and God used him, and just what a gift that was for God to allow him to see from afar, you know, what his life work had been about, And I just thought that was a cool parallel too at the end with Caesar watching the apes enter the promised land.
Yeah, as he drifted off.
Well, I love that scene. Mm-hmm. That was the one place where I got a little bit choked up. I mean, I love emotion and I feel emotion. I don't get choked up very much though. Mm-hmm. Like unless it has something to do with my kids or if it's a, if it has something that makes me think of my kids, but with this, it was, you know, it was when he sat down next to Maurice, or Maurice sat down next to him rather. And they were framed and we've seen them sit like this a couple times in the first movie. And I think a couple times in the second movie where it's just, Caesar sitting next to Maurice and having a conversation. And Maurice is one of Caesar's wisdom people, you know, that he sits and listens and who has Caesar's ear. And when they sat down like that, it was just like, oh, we're right back there with that relationship. And I didn't realize he was going to die quite then, but I probably should have realized that he was going to die right then. It wasn't until he's like, oh, ow, ooh, you know, I got this, this sticky stuff, you know.
Because he had his side pierced?
Wow.
I don't want to go too much with the Christ imagery for Caesar, because it's not, I mean, you could probably, I mean, they crucify him. Mm-hmm. You know, they do literally crucify him. And I guess you could almost make the case that he was as good as dead, if not dead, you know. And yeah, I guess you could go there if you wanted to.
I'd rather not. People do that, though, because, you know, because he's flawed. I don't know. It's just because it's not a perfect metaphor.
There never is, though. And that's the thing. There's no such thing, honestly, as a perfect metaphor. I mean, even Jesus' parables, you could poke holes in them if you really wanted to take it far enough. But it's not what he intended. You know, you look at what the intent was, not like the perfect nitpicky one-to-one correlation between seeds and the Word of God or whatever. But that – see, the thing for me that stuck out was, you know, we're talking about all these big ideas and this like inner war and stuff like that. But for me, what stuck out was just these small little moments of – small kindness is what I called it. I did a short video for Strangers and Aliens about this, and it was just after I'm an internal processor, and I've just been thinking about like just all these small kindnesses, and it kind of starts with Maurice and Nova, and we haven't even started getting into the real geeky like references to all the other Planet of the Apes movies that this makes, but he just does a small kindness for Nova, just gives her the doll. You know, and then later on, you have the whole thing with the, you know, Caesar's drink and his water, and she's thirsty, and he gives it to her, and blah blah blah. But when she comes into the jail, she walks right into the camp, and that's another one that's a plot thing that theme is driving the plot here. She should not be able to walk into the camp, but she needs to walk into the camp so she can get to where the story needs her to be, to do the thing that she needs to do for Caesar. And the moment is a wonderful little moment where she's, you know, giving him seeds to eat, or grain rather, to eat, and gives him her doll. And they frame the POV shot of him looking at her the same way they frame the POV shot of her looking at Maurice earlier in the movie. And it's just this small kindness that gives him a little bit more life and allows him to be able to, you know, do the things that he needs to do. And it feeds into his arc. You know, this small thing she does for him totally is what pushes him on his, you know, final arc. But you know what's going to happen. When he has a showdown with the colonel, the surprise would be if he pulled the trigger. Mm-hmm. That would be the surprise, if he actually went ahead and went through with it. And again, that's what I'm saying, is we've seen this story before, of the revenge story. I'm out to kill. But, oh, if I kill, I'm just like him. You know, and then and it's even worse in some ways, though, the way he leaves him. Like, oh, you're going to just have this disease. I'm going to put the gun here for you. There you go.
Like you don't know what he's going to do.
Yeah. It's almost like the whole Batman won't kill. You know, I'm putting the gun right here, right where you want it. And I know this is what you want. And yeah, but then he turns around and leaves and goes and does the, you know, the hero moment outside that causes the avalanche that everyone talks about being like the parting of the Red Sea. Which is, it's a biblical moment, that avalanche is.
Just a side note, and you can continue, Ben, but I think it's so cool, too, that that kindness that Nova shows is actually the thing that leads to the colonel's downfall. It's not, you know, some big act of war infiltration in his office. Like, he actually quietly, after all the noise he's made, he's, like, quietly suffering and, you know, and whatever the word
is. But it's the doll. It was the doll that carried the disease for him. And, yeah, too bad.
She literally killed him with kindness.
Yeah.
That just happened. Well, I in my notes, I wrote down that much has been made of the biblical parallels. So what? Because I'm not trying to necessarily bag on lots of the reviews, and lots of the reviews I'll even link in our show notes, but lots of the reviews say, look at all these biblical parallels.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I mean, especially, you know, for our purposes, most of the reviews that we're linking are going to be reviews from Christian reviewers. Even some of the comments that I got before I had to see the movie, and people were talking about, like, oh, I can't wait to see what Real World says about this, because it basically writes itself. I realized after seeing the film, they were basically just pointing out, or they were just saying, there's lots of biblical, like, obvious biblical ties there. But, so what? Like, that's not really pulling the theme out.
Mm-hmm.
That's just saying, well, they had some good source material. Or, yeah, as you said, Ben, you know, it's a plot we see many times. So I said, so what? And it was when I was reading, I feel like I'm, like, every other episode, I'm pull quoting from Elijah Davidson at this point, but I think he really is a very fine, and obviously why we have him on the show and stuff, a fine reviewer for film and theology over Real Spirituality. And I could read a lot of this to really prove my point, but I'm going to read just a little excerpt. One of the very last things that he says after pointing out that there's biblical parallels and kind of what that means is he says, as biblically informed audience members, it is our privilege to be able to bring our knowledge of biblical stories to the cultural conversation about these new stories, hopefully not in an arrogant way, but as a humble witness eager to open up new narrative worlds for others. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, like, you know, that's another one of those, you could slap this down as, like, a mission statement for why we're here, a mission statement for why we do what we do, and hopefully what we're encouraging anyone listening to do. You know, go see this and say, yeah. You think that story's cool?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me tell you, like, about this story and why it's even cooler.
Mm-hmm.
And not, again, in an arrogant way, but kind of like we're doing now, like, this really reminds me of something that has a little bit more impact than a movie. And not to co-opt the film, not to co-opt the message of the film, but like I said, people are going to be drawn to these stories.
Actually, something that Joel Mayward said in his review, was helpful to me on that question. He was talking about how biblical films are always, they're always colored by the culture that they're coming into.
Mm-hmm.
They're always, like, shaped by the culture that they're coming into. So they say something about the culture that, of the time and place that the movie is coming out. And, I don't know, that was really challenging to me just in terms of my belief in scripture, because really what he's saying is that, the importance of the biblical narrative being there is that, the opportunity is that they're using a story that is truth, and that truth is showing something about our current time, our current culture.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge for me there was that, yeah, these stories are really powerful. These truths are really powerful. They're not just some story. And, you know, I don't know, I guess I just, it kind of renewed for me, like, yeah, there's, the Bible is full of really instructive, powerful story that can help us to be, you know, better people, I guess, if you want to
make it, like, oversimplify it.
Yeah, if I'm going to oversimplify it, but really can just speak into the struggles that we're having or the problems that we're having, or, you know, that can.
Yeah. I wrote down one of the things that Joel had said towards the end after he made that point,
because
he was arguing ultimately that one of the reasons that War for the Planet of the Apes was significant was that it was a biblical epic for our time. So he says, like, in our present era of divisiveness and global unrest, where refugees and are refused at borders, religious fanatics pursue modern-day crusades, and American political leaders dupe the religious into believing nationalist agendas, War for the Planet of the Apes is the biblical epic for our time, one which condemns retributive violence and lauds acts of mercy and grace towards one's neighbors, regardless of species. And so I bring lots of this up to throw you the ball, Ben, because I know that as a writer, you're doing this. Like, sometimes you're specifically writing biblical stories for the comics, but you're also shaping biblical narrative in a medium, if not in a metaphor or allegory, so people can access it.
Yeah, and I've got two kind of answers to what you're talking about, the so what kind of idea here. And one is, you know, you're talking about the biblical story and how when it's told, you know, when the actual stories from the Bible are told in our time now, it's done so for our time with an agenda toward our time. You know, so that's, you know, Exodus, Noah, you know, those movies, they were changed. And the changes were very, very obvious, but they were also changed for a reason by the person who did it. On the other hand, you have people telling, you know, conservative Christians, especially like myself, telling the stories. And again, it's still your worldview is there, mm-hmm, and it's going to seep through. And so, I mean, I try my hardest whenever I do any kind of writing. I really try hard. Especially the historical fiction with Bible stuff and or if I'm doing I've done a couple biographies as well. I try very hard to get out of the way. Actually, even when I was working on the George Martin books, the Hedge Knight books, I try very hard to get out of the way, let the story speak for itself. Now, one of the reasons why I did Hedge Knight in the first place was because there was some themes in there that resonated with me that I wanted to make sure were visible, mm-hmm, and that people hopefully saw that as well. I don't know how successful I was at it or not. I've had a couple conversations with people about them, but no one's ever said, "Hey, yeah, that thing you were thinking, is this, you know?" And yes, that's it. I've never had that conversation, but the changes are going to happen. And what's good about this kind of a story here, as opposed to say, you know, Exodus or Ten Commandments, even, I mean, we can go back to not just the more recent ones, but even the classic ones, mm-hmm, where there's changes for cinematic reasons, or there's changes for this reason or that reason. This story of Moses, they can change whatever they want and, mm-hmm, to say whatever they want. You know, they're drawing on things. And so that's where, when you say, so what, the answer to my question is, yeah, it's actually, I agree with the sentiment in some ways. Like, that's actually when we came out of the movie, those biblical references, I mean, in our podcast, if you ever hear it, the Moses thing kind of comes up almost as an aside. Mm-hmm. We're like, this was the story of Moses, you know, ha ha. it was these other things that we were talking about, especially like the theme of this kindness, or I can't remember how the person in the review that you read said it, but we're talking about that same kind of thing of compassion. That's you know, showing compassion for your enemy or your family. This movie is just the biblical stuff is literary reference. Mm. To me, the biblical stuff in this movie is almost as much a reference. And this might be the one weakness, is this movie is just referring to lots and lots of other movies, mm-hmm, and lots of other stories. And it's doing so to make a point and to say something. But, you know, this is a movie that is asking you to remember these big Bible epics. This is a movie that's asking you to remember these classic war movies. This is a movie that's asking you to remember 70s spaghetti westerns. That's honestly one of the reasons why I love this movie so much, I think, is the vibe of just the stark, solitary journey, you know, and the music itself. He's referencing old spaghetti westerns, and then the other thing it's asking you to remember is the original Planet of the Apes movies. And it's just, mm-hmm, dropping like all these little Oh, remember Nova? Oh, remember Moses? Oh, remember Jesus on the cross? Oh, remember Clint Eastwood when he was going out for revenge? Oh, remember? And it's just like all these things, and it's kind of then stirred up into a pot, and it's kind of, in a lot of ways, a much more visible hodgepodge of what writers do anyway, which is mm-hmm. To take all of our experiences in life and our experiences in literature and our experiences in other people's lives that we've heard about and mixing it all up to tell a story that hopefully has some meaning and hopefully has some value. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's probably the one knock is just there's so many references. But then to me, the themes and the characters and the artistry that goes into it, much more than the plot, really resound with me. Mm-hmm. And, that theme of small kindness, that's just the thing that I can't get over it. It just sticks with me and has stuck with me, and it just resounds with me. And part of it is because I'm trying to teach this stuff to my children. Part of it is I'm trying to overcome this stuff in my own heart. My coba is, bitterness and anger sometimes. And I've got a 6-year-old who I had a whole conversation right before I went and saw this movie about, being nice to people on the playground and, and talking about how it is. I was prophesying about this movie because I was talking with him about how it is so much easier to be mean mm-hmm. and it is so much easier to just let your mouth go and say what you're thinking without stopping to process how is this going to affect someone. Now, I didn't use these big words, but it is much easier. The words I actually used was it's a lot easier to just get mad at someone and call them a butthead than it is to stop yourself and to say to them, I didn't like that. Please don't do it. Mm-hmm. And actually I was really proud of my son because out of that conversation, he said, so what happens when those girls say mean things to me? Cause there was girls on the, this is at camp and there's some girls at the playground who he's seeing every day and they weren't putting up with him. He was 6 and he wanted to be on the merry-go-round and they were 9 and they wanted to go faster. And so they're saying some mean things to him. And I said, here's what you need to say to them. And I scripted it for him when I said this, maybe it was the wrong thing to say, but I said, here's what you say to them. Just say to them, you know what? I didn't like what you said, but Jesus still loves you or something like that. I can't remember if those were my exact words, but close to that. Mm-hmm. And the next day when I came back, because I wasn't staying at the camp with my family, I was actually staying at home so I could get a real shower and sleep in a real bed when I went into the office. But when I got home or when I got back to the camp after work, he said, Dad, I said that to those girls. I'm like, okay, so how'd it go? And he said, I said to them, Jesus still loves you. And they said, oh yeah, well, we already knew that. A church camp. And I said, you know what, Doug, don't worry about it because what you did, you reminded them of something they already knew. And that's a good thing too, and when they said that to you, that wasn't nice, but you know what? They're learning. We're all still learning. Even I am still learning how to be nice to people. And it was just really funny because it was right before I saw this movie and right after it when I was kind of talking with my son about it. It's just easier to be mean. It's easier to strike out in anger. And it's easier to hold the grudge that's going to make it so you'll go through all the hard stuff so you can strike out in anger. Mm-hmm. And it's just, yeah, that's what stuck out to me. And so all the biblical stuff is dressing. Mm-hmm. It's window dressing, and it is part of the cultural conversation that we can have because biblical literacy is something that even churchgoers don't have anymore. Mm-hmm. You can't. Time was in the 50s and 60s, you could reference David and Goliath anywhere, and everyone was going to at least understand what you were talking about. You do that now, and people might have heard, and there'll be some people who are right on target with you, but there's a large portion of contemporary American culture that just they don't understand. Yeah. You bring up David and Goliath and they might think it about a giant, but they aren't going to understand what you mean when you say it's a David and Goliath situation.
Which is why it's so I think it's so cool to see biblical truths in films like this that feel accessible to a much broader audience. Mm-hmm. Because then we can have these conversations, we being people who have biblical literacy, can have conversations with people who don't and be able to make those connections for people that aren't going to make them on their own. I think I'm just thinking as you're talking about this idea of choosing kindness and how it's harder. And I'm thinking about how Caesar is a leader and really in the footsteps of Christ, meaning that I think in our world we think of leadership as being associated just with power, with strength, but when Christ talks about being a leader, it's often associated with sacrifice, with weakness, with giving up, you know. And I think that's where Caesar's strength is as a leader, is that he has people that he'll listen to, that he'll take counsel from. I feel like I heard this from, what is it, Matt Reeve? Is he the guy who directed this? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I heard this from something he said where he was talking about how empathy is actually what sets Caesar apart from everybody else, that it's his empathy that makes him what he is or elevates him to the position that he's in. So, yeah, it just strikes me that it's he's a great leader because it's not about him, because he's not at the top, you know, and he's constantly, and then when he's starting kind of to take on these characteristics of other leaders like Koba, you know, leaders that he doesn't want to be like, it's people like Lake, it's people like Nova and Maurice who bring him back from that and make him a great leader again. So I was just impressed by that. Just that thread throughout, that what makes Caesar so inspiring is actually something that I think not many of us really want to do, which is to allow ourselves to feel, to be weak, to listen to others, to not be in control, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, and everything that goes wrong in this movie happens because he doesn't listen mm-hmm. to yeah. others, and because he's not being empathetic, because he is on the journey for revenge rather than, you know, what's best for the tribe. Now, the problem is they do pull their punches a little bit, because when he says, "I'm going to go and do that, I have to do this alone, I have to do this, you know, on my own," and when he's doing that, he also then couches it as, "They'll be distracted by me. And so you have a better chance of sneaking away than mm-hmm. if I, you know." And so then suddenly it's, okay, it's not just him doing the wrong thing. It's him doing the wrong thing, but kind of doing the right thing. And mm-hmm. and then again, I mean,
it certainly seems like he's just justifying it. He doesn't yeah. actually believe that.
But on the other hand, I mean, that's solid strategy. I mean, it's, you know, if... I mean, that's how the Germans invaded France, was, you know, everyone was watching these more, you know, strong borders, and then they're able to come through this weaker border with Belgium, because France was at peace with Belgium, and then Germany took Belgium and was able to use the border there to come through.
And, okay, so now the apes are Nazis. I really think you've gone off the rails here, Ben.
I think I
could go off the rails more if you wanted me to, but...
maybe Caesar really did believe that at some level, you know, that he was doing it for other people. I remember a part though of the film when he's in the camp and he sees Cornelius and he says, "What have I done?" And that to me kind of speaks to that, where he's realizing there's no justification for, you know, for the path I've taken.
Yeah. Yep. And I mean, that's the whole journey, is him figuring out that he's done this. I mean, he's broken the other law, mm-hmm. right? Apes yeah. together strong, mm-hmm. you know, he's going off on his own. Of course, then again, they kind of pull their punches there because his friends come. And yeah. so he's no longer doing it alone, like, until one of them gets
to do this alone.
Okay. You can come.
Well, I mean, I guess if you guys are real, I'll go.
Yeah. If you insist.
Yeah.
Okay. No, for real.
No, fine. Real. Okay.
Which no. I was going to say, if Caesar was strategizing in a, you know, in a good way, that was probably the only good strategy the apes had. We were talking about how, in the film, even when we were watching it, about how stupid it was that all of them always entered like a building together went in the same direction.
I was like, speaking of war movies, I don't have to watch that many war movies to know that you don't all go in the building together, because that's how you get ambushed. Like, someone goes around back, someone stays at the front door, and the other people go in. And you probably throw a grenade in first. But that's not a different So, well, outside of war strategy, there is one pressing question that I need to ask you guys to kind of wind this down. And Ben, hopefully this is an easy question, even though it's very important. On a scale of 1 to 10, how necessary is it that Andy Serkis gets an Oscar for his motion capture work?
How necessary? He's not going to.
Oh, I know he's not going to.
I mean, it's not going to happen. He'll get one when he plays Cornelius mm-hmm. in the next movie. because that's where we have to go. You know, he's going to follow the Roddy McDowall thing and play his son, mm-hmm. and then the Academy will be ready for it. How necessary is it this year? I mean, I don't think it's necessary. I mean, two. they don't have to. I mean, I understand why people are saying it, and he did. I mean, you see his emotion through.
Yeah.
And it is, that is another thing that just drew me in, was the camera lingers on his face and allows him to emote. And we don't linger ever, you know, in blockbuster movies. Mm-hmm. We don't linger unless it's to get that single tear to try and force emotion from the audience. Mm-hmm. And although we did get the single tear when he died too, which is again referencing old Planet of the Apes. Because I was hoping you were going to go into, like, how do you talk? You know, there's so much stuff. Alpha Omega, Nova. I mean, there's so many different things that they reference those old movies.
At the end of the episode, we'll just leave the mic on and we'll go to bed and we'll just let you talk about it, and yeah. It'll be like an extra episode. Yeah.
It's there. Just trust me. I'm going to just say there's a lot of stuff that was cool referencing. And mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, I mean, so that was going to be my other hypothetical, and it's like, you know, this trilogy has essentially been the prequels to the, you know, 68, 69, 70, 71, 70, you know, mm-hmm. like all those films. So, like, do we want more, or do we just kind of be like, hey, it's alone. It prequels into the old films. Well, or do we tell more stories?
Well, I could go either way. Mm-hmm. I'm happy with this ending.
Yeah.
I'm very, when he died and the people were in the promised land, I'm like, that is the perfect ending. We saw him get kidnapped from his home. We saw him or his mother get kidnapped from her home. Perfect ending. We could stop right here. But if we're not going to stop right here, then they have to be really careful and just mm-hmm. make a really, really good next trilogy movie. Start it off with a good movie. And then if you have to stop there, it's okay. Mm-hmm. But if you can continue, you continue. And they just have to keep the level of quality. And that's where I want to see it go. So, I don't want to see it necessarily go to a – I don't want to see it go to a remake of the original.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't want to see them, like, butt it up against the original. The originals are so far removed from these movies for me that while they're of a kind and they belong together, like, on my shelf, they aren't – I could figure out, and I have figured out, a way for everything in the franchise, except for the comics and some of the extra stuff.
And the Tim Burton movie.
The Tim Burton movie fits in the timeline. It does. I can fit it into the timeline. Everything fits into
why
this.
Would you want to?
Well, because it's there, you know. But it's a Back to the Future timeline where time changes and then we start a new timeline and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it all fits into this timeline. This is it doesn't fit in there for me. And I guess if I could really try and shoehorn it in, maybe I'd be able to. This is its own thing. And I appreciate all the references to all the things that happened and came before. But at the same time, I don't want it to be an actual prequel to the original movies. I don't want to see these characters, you know, in another 3 or 6 movies start wearing green jumpsuits. And all of a sudden Dr. Zaius is there. I don't want that. Hmm. I wouldn't mind seeing another Dr. Zaius, who's a different Dr. Zaius, who's an echo of the original. In the same way that Battlestar Galactica, it was an echo of the original. And they kept saying, all this has happened before, and they're referring to, you know, we've done this plot kind of before, mm-hmm. but it's completely different, and it's not tied in, and we're not part of the same timeline. It's a different thing. And that's what I like, is that it echoes against it, but it isn't a part of it.
Mm-hmm. actually think I love it because the more I paid attention, the more I felt like it was a very solid prequel that wasn't concerned. It seemed like it wasn't concerned with the original films, but the original films gave it enough material that it didn't feel caged by it. But it was informed and made it better.
Yeah, no, definitely informed. But I mean, if we're gonna get nitpicky about things, then it doesn't. It's not the same world. Like it can't be. There's certain things that happen. I mean, and this is where I'm sure I could find a way to do a headcanon that makes it work. I just don't want to, because I just love that this is a standalone trilogy.
And
we'll see what happens in the future.
But yeah,
I'm content.
Well, like I said, it all depends on how much money it makes.
Yeah,
that's true.
It seems like this iteration of the human race was not advanced enough to have created time travel, or
well, you know what I'm saying? I mean, but the time travel that happens in the first movie, and now I'm gonna get the time travel happens in the first movie is accidental, because I mean it's not accidental, but it's incidental mm-hmm. to the way that they're just traveling through space. They're traveling to the future at a faster rate of speed for, you know, so that they aren't dead when they should be, because they've been traveling faster than light mm-hmm. or close to the speed of light. The time travel in the third movie is accidental. It shouldn't have happened, but it's a spaceship that goes back in time accidentally. And so that humans hadn't
developed created that.
Time.
Okay.
Yeah. They didn't create the time travel. So I'm okay with that, but there are things about when things happened, and there was definitely a nuclear war
mm-hmm.
prior to the first Planet of the Apes movie. So when does a nuclear war fit into the timeline of this new trilogy? That's the biggest thing for me is, and maybe it happened. I mean, we're on the West Coast in this movie, and who knows what's going on in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Bad Ape. We haven't talked about him much either, but he shows that I think with the virus that was killing off people, this is what I assumed was happening. With the virus that was killing off people, it was also causing apes to advance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was a surprise to everyone in this movie. Oh, there's other ones like us out there?
Mm-hmm.
Who would have thunk it? You know, but yeah. So that's, again, who knows where they're gonna go with it. I'm if it's good, I'm willing to roll with it.
Yeah. Well, like I said, if they don't do anything else, I think this has been a really great trilogy that I think Laura and I have been evangelizing to people to see for years. You know, I feel like we really were like, you know, hey, Rise was surprisingly good. You know, like we enjoyed it a surprising amount. But then once Dawn came out, we were like, you guys really need to watch these movies. Like, I know you hear like the words Planet of the Apes and you're like, old busted franchise from the late 60s, early 70s. You know, just another, you know, or just another remake or just another reboot. But like, I was like, there's something here and I think mm-hmm. you'll enjoy them. And it's been really great to see people who have done that and come back and said, man, I watched those first two and there's really a lot there. And I'm like, right?
Mm-hmm. And right. I think they surprisingly appeal to people who wouldn't normally go for that kind of genre.
Yeah. I think they've got enough going on that it defies what people would normally like.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, honestly, the apes are so real. But it's just really cool. Like, you forget.
The drama is human drama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what it's going to draw you in.
Mm-hmm.
It's talking
about, like, the essential, like, what it means to be human kind of stuff, too. So I think that really appeals.
Well, to wrap up, we have brought back for a couple episodes now our come on moments and our favorite moments. So, Ben, I'm kind of curious. I don't think this movie was perfect.
No.
So I think there were some things that could make you kind of scratch your head and say, come on. So did you have anything like that?
There's two come on moments I can think of. One is Bad Ape just falling and finding the tunnels that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was Maurice accidentally causing a flood Like, what was he doing when he was like picking at the wall and then, oh, and he floods the tunnel so badly that they can't use the, I mean, there's other come on moments probably that I could think of, mm-hmm. but most of them I was willing to roll with because I'm with the movie, mm-hmm. you know, I'm on the movie side. Mm-hmm. It's not what I'm expecting, but I'm on its side. But those two Bad Apes, comic relief didn't bother me much, but that's when it did, mm-hmm. yeah. because most of it up until that point is kind of sweet. You know, it was character stuff. It was, I mean, that's another emotional character. Who was emoting through the CGI for me. I didn't find him annoying mm-hmm. until he was like, slapstick. You know,
I stepped on a rake. Who knew?
Yeah, yeah. And then I fell over backwards and thump. I'm okay.
No, I think that's more than fair. How about you, Laura?
I mean, I said this to you in the theater or afterwards, and I don't think you agree with me, but... So there was a lot of mystery in this film about specifically about like where are these people? You know, they hid like the whole thing about the other army that was coming and why they were coming, and there was a lot of mystery around the humans that were being killed, but uh-huh. you know, and why they couldn't speak, and so I just felt like I was really intrigued by all that stuff, and it was kind of unfolding very slowly for me. And then I felt like suddenly we're in the room with the colonel, and he's just laying it all out in a nice long speech. And you know, that happens a lot. That's
villains got to exposit. Yeah.
You know, they don't give his name, but his name is actually Colonel Basil Exposition.
It all makes sense now. So. Yeah, I just kind of felt like, why is he still talking, and why is he talking in such detail about all these things that we didn't know about before? I think it was just, it kind of just killed that momentum for me. Mm-hmm. I just kind of wanted there to be kind of like a, oh my gosh, we've discovered this has happened, instead of him just being like, and people can't talk now, and I don't like that, you know?
So... I mean, like, it didn't bother me a ton at the time. It still obviously was obvious what it was doing. Mm-hmm. So, obvious scene is obvious. Maybe I'm just used to it.
It didn't bother me either. I didn't really notice the exposition dump that was happening until it was someone mentioned it. And I was like, oh, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
I do think the other thing that really bothered me was the fact that when Caesar leaves them and they're like, going to the, you know, trying to go to the other land, I was just like, this seems like a kind of a dumbly structured society. Like, who takes over for him? Like, all his people left. And so what are they going to do? Like, who are they even following? Who's the lead horse?
Yeah. Who is in
the leaders all left?
Yeah.
I was all like, four of the leaders.
I was like, none of them said maybe one of us should stay behind. Like,
and not the person who's pre-scouted the land. Wasn't that Rocket? Mm-hmm. He was just like, oh, I'll just leave you all. And I'll just like, did he give him like a map?
He's like, oh,
because Rocket and Bright Eyes went.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Bright Eyes dead. Mm-hmm. Rocket.
Yeah. Caesar's like, hey, Rocket, I'll leave you in charge. And Rocket's like, hey, Steve the Ape, you're now in charge. And Steve the Ape's like, you know, he's like busy like trying to throw his poo and stuff. And he's like, what? He can't even talk. You know, he just signs. Like, what? But he's got poo on his hands, so no one's really paying attention. Because they're like, oh, man. Old Dookie Hand Steve.
No, he's in charge.
Dookie Hand Steve's in charge. And that's why they got caught. You know?
That's right.
Oh, if only Rocket was in charge instead of Dookie Hand Steve.
What about you?
What about me?
Dookie Hand Steve was your come on?
No, like, I really... honestly, my come on moments were there were probably some overarching ones, but like, just for the story's sake, like I kind of suspended my criticism just because I was so interested in the characters themselves. Mm-hmm. Like most of the, like I said, the overarching story stuff, I was willing to forgive, and you know, didn't really think of it as a criticism. But the things that I think about now that are still criticisms are basic strategy. Like, every time they walked into a house, all of them, single file. Like, that really did bother me.
Yeah.
Like,
how are you still alive
kind of thing? Yeah, I'm like, why would you why would you do that? Like, that's, like, I don't know. Anyway, I was like, just watch any war movie and realize that's terrible strategy. Or, like, haven't you got ambushed by humans enough over the course of 2 years that you know you don't, like, they can just burn the house down, you know, like, lock mm-hmm. both the sides of the doors? Haven't you seen Braveheart? That's a terrible thing to do.
Well, they were showing some military prowess in the opening scene, too, so.
Yeah, well.
And to be fair, I mean, they're living a pretty simple life right now. You know, they're not going out trying to restore power so they can watch DVDs.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Maybe Bad Ape would be interested in
doing that. I mean, like, we see where the problem is now, you know. Misplaced priorities. But yeah, I mean, other than that, I mean, like, it was things like that where the things that bothered me didn't affect how much I cared about the characters or where the story was going, so it was fine. Okay, so favorite moments, Ben. What was your favorite moment in this movie?
Well, I think I've already talked about my favorite moment is probably the girl helping Caesar.
Gotcha.
I mean, I there's just something so kind and gentle about that scene. And I understand the ridiculousness of some of the things that led up to the scene. I mean, just the fact that she was able to walk through this camp that's getting ready for war, right? I mean, they've got guards, or they should. But she was able to just walk right in. But I'm willing to go with it. I mean, the other thing is they're getting ready for war. So maybe it is something where no one noticed it because they're also focused on getting ready for this war. But mm-hmm. That's the standout moment for me. And then just the vibe, you know, just that 70s kind of spaghetti Western vibe where it just, that's fine.
No, that works. Laura?
I guess I would say there were a couple of really redemptive moments that I think landed really well. And actually one of them was with Red Donkey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, because maybe more than, at least in the ape-like society, more than any other character, that character had really gone down a dark path that he was committed to.
Mm-hmm.
And just to see that Caesar could still affect him,
mm-hmm.
you know, could still make him see that he could be better, that he could, I don't know, that was... I was moved by that. And then the end, I mean, the very end with Caesar, I really enjoyed that, those last moments with Maurice. And I think really, cause it's just heartening to me to see that played out, that you can stumble through life. You can make bad choices. You can try really hard, you know, I don't know that there's redemption, even if you've gone down a wrong path. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. So when it comes to favorite moments, I think that one of the reasons that this movie wasn't I rated it as high as I could have, like places where it could have been better, was because I really enjoyed basically the whole movie, but I never had a moment or two where I said, that was so awesome.
Mm.
Like, that was the thing that got me. And like I said, not that means there's no really great moments, but like, it wasn't like, I just don't feel like there's a favorite moment for me. And I wanted there to be a couple of those just sprinkled throughout. And, I don't know if it's just because it didn't affect me personally or what, but I thought, and I couldn't think of a favorite moment. So I think in the spirit of favorite moment, what I will say, and basically what did make me just really enjoy the film from start to finish, is that with just the way that people use CGI and motion capture, I feel like it's often squandered or cheap or quick or lazy. And for Dawn, we talked about this, I'm pretty sure, a lot on the episode. And then now with War, again, whoever you want to give credit to, you know, I know some of it goes to like Andy Serkis and the other actors who are doing motion capture, you know, your visual effects team, heck, even the directors, things like that. Whatever it is, I never, during this film, stopped and thought the apes weren't real. Mm-hmm. I never said, oh, look at that. Look how fake that looks. And I think that's one of the biggest things that allows this movie to be successful. Because most people would say, oh, I had to suspend my disbelief for that movie because, you know, it's a Fast and the Furious movie and things are blowing up, or a Transformers movie where things obviously look like mm-hmm. they're computer generated. Mm-hmm. But you can suspend your disbelief for certain things in this movie, but suspension of disbelief that these apes are not real is not something that you have to do, mm-hmm. which would be a huge hurdle, and it's not a hurdle at all. And I think that's amazing. I think that is truly amazing to have that much CGI, like, staring you in the face, literally, and it not even need to be in the back of your mind. Mm-hmm. So that's probably my favorite thing about these movies, because I think that's what helps it. I think that's what helps it literally come to life. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, it's closest thing I have probably to a favorite moment. And with that, I think it's probably time that we say goodbye. But I knew I was going to enjoy talking about this movie, and I knew I was going to enjoy talking about it with you two. One, because like I said, I think I've already mentioned that. Laura, you and I talk about these movies all the time anyway. And Ben, I really enjoyed you just getting to get like right up to the point of like indignation about like things that are not correct, and your knowledge of the franchise, I think is awesome. So
hopefully I didn't cross the line.
No.
One of
my favorite things about having conversations about movies is people who are really into like either the genre or the specific movie. Mm-hmm. And they can bring a lot to that conversation, and obviously you can. So, like I always say, great conversations happen because we have great guests, and we have two great ones. So Ben, I want people to know how they can follow your work or, just follow you, around the web.
Yeah. One of the best ways to follow like my work is, on Facebook at Facebook.com. I'm Ben Avery Storyteller is my comic page where I talk about the projects I'm working on, and sometimes I'll throw a podcast episode in there and stuff. I don't spam people's feed yet, but who knows, maybe I'll have to just try and sell more comics, but that's where you can find me. But strangersandaliens.com, that's where I do this kind of conversation all the time, with two other hosts, Steve and Evan, and then we bring in guests every once in a while. And then there's welcometolevel7.com, where we talk about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That's everything, which is getting a little crazy right now. it's very difficult. We're behind. We're way behind. We just finished, or we'll be finishing tomorrow, our coverage of season 2 of Daredevil. We stay on top of every weekly episode, but as far as Netflix, like that's just when we can get to it.
Yeah.
So we're not going to be ready for Defenders when Defenders rolls around, or Inhumans, or Cloak and Dagger.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And then there's also Comic Book Time Machine, and that's where I talk about that's my fun podcast. Welcome to Level 7 is the okay, we gotta do this, gotta crank these out, gotta get these done on the weekend, you know, so we can be ready to talk about the next episode. Strangers and Aliens we do every week, but it's conversations where with a little more depth and that. Comic Book Time Machine is just where I read comic books and talk about comic books. And I do that with Daniel Butcher and Matt Anderson, and it's just whatever strikes my fancy, whatever strikes their fancy. And so I get to talk about swamp monsters a lot more there than I get to talk about them anywhere, you know? So
that's so anyway, odd. You think that'd be just a normal thing that people talked about all the time?
Yeah.
Well, I hoped, but then people give me these looks, you know, and it's just, maybe that's not how to strike up a conversation online at Barnes and Noble.
Well, yeah. Laura, how can people follow, the things that you do?
Like, come to the house and watch me parent our son. I mean, in terms of like film and theology or story, probably my Doctor Who reviews on Real World Theology. I'm at Laura_Fissel on Twitter.
Boom. You tweet all the time.
Oh man, I tweet at least once a year.
You see? Consistency. That's what gets you followers.
That's right. I do have a project that I'm not currently working on. I mean, I'm not currently adding to, but it's archived and still relevant, and mm-hmm. it's called familyrestoried.com, and it's a collection of stories from I think mostly women at this point, but just about miscarriage and infertility.
Mm. So if you're having a good day, go there. It's a real upper.
Sometimes it is.
It is an upper. I'm just picking. I'll make sure you have all those links in the show notes, as usual, over at realworldtheology.com. You can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. Sadly, I don't tweet all as much as I should, unless you want to hear like indignant rants about what happened in wrestling this week. if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by going to realworldtheology.com/support. And as always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Please leave us a review. It helps more than you know. Thanks to all the people. There has been a couple extra people who have reviewed the show lately. Thank you so much. Thanks for the 5-star reviews. It keeps us cranking along, until next episode. So for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
I feel like we should do some kind of like ape thing.
Ape thing?
Like ape impression or something.
That's apist.
Podcast.
I thought it would be like...
It's done.
Podcast.
Now.
Done.
It's
now
over.
Podcast never over. Podcast together. Strong. Podcast. No kill podcast.
Those are best. I mean they work.
Yes. I'm saying.
How about podcasters together strong?
No. Podcasters. Together. Strong.